This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
When I'm looking at the next 12 months of my life, what I do not have on the books and what is impossible for me to have on the books is a trip to Sicily. However, the next best thing to having my own adventure in Sicily was reading Joe Piazza's new novel, The Sicilian Inheritance. It is a vacation in a book. If your vacations were sexy murder mysteries that also dive deep into generational trauma, but not in too heavy of a way, it is the perfect book to take on a plane. It is the perfect book to read next to your public pool while taking breaks to yell at your kids. It is the perfect book to get you out of a reading slump, and it is available now wherever you get books.
Hello, hello, hello. My guest today consistently blows my mind in this episode, and I think you can hear the awe in my voice and the moments where I'm like, okay. Filed this one away for later. Yeah. I truly believe that Maggie Jackson is one of the most interesting writers and thinkers on technology's impact on humanity. Her new book, Uncertain, The Wisdom and Wonder of Being Unsure, has shaken up my brain in so many new and wonderful ways. The central question of today's episode is whether or not a daily dose of uncertainty is exactly what we need. What if we stopped fearing uncertainty? Can we be challenged by it, but can we also really thrive in it? And let's be honest, nothing feels more uncertain than motherhood. Nothing. Birth never goes to plan. Babies don't follow any playbooks. And that uncertainty can very easily break us. But maybe, just maybe, what we should be doing as mothers and as parents is embracing that uncertainty, is approaching all of this with curiosity instead of the dread that often comes along when we don't know what's going to happen next. Maggie contends that we should rethink our outdated notions of not knowing as a weakness and instead discover that feeling uncertainty can be a strength. As she says, tolerating and even delighting in uncertainty doesn't merely help us accept life's unpredictabilities, of which there are many, it also readies us to learn and adapt. Hello, Maggie Jackson. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, it's so wonderful to be here with you. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So we are going to talk about something that I think makes a lot of us very uncomfortable. Today, we're going to talk about uncertainty. And I am a person that is particularly uncomfortable with uncertainty for so many reasons that I've talked about in therapy for a very long time. But I think a lot more people are in that uncertain place than before for a lot of reasons. And you explore so much of this so beautifully in your new book. Why have you found are we in such an uncertain place right now?
Sure. Well, it helps to understand a little bit about the kinds of uncertainties that humans face. So just in brief, we are in a period of great unpredictability, volatility, you know, from everything from job hours to the weather patterns. So we all know that it's in the headlines. But that's a certain kind of uncertainty, so to speak, That's called aleatory uncertainty. And it's really a shorthand for the unknown, you know, kind of what you can't control, what you can't really fully know, even if you have an app for that, even if you've got the models, et cetera. You don't know if it's going to rain 3 inches or 5 inches on your backyard next Tuesday, et cetera. That's one kind of uncertainty. So that is actually, studies show that's rising in many, many areas of life. But at the same time, there's our uncertainty, epistemic or psychological uncertainty. And that's our human response to the unknown. And that's what I'm writing about, how we can better contend with the unknown, how we can confront it and manage it, et cetera. And so there's a lot we can do in that space. It starts with that ease, you know, all the way up to anxiety, but natural unease. So I think that's really the starting point to understanding how uncertain, it's not the uncertainty that actually kind of, drags us down. It's our fear of the uncertainty. So when we face up something new or unexpected, it could be the traffic jam or the storm that's coming down the, pike toward us or that kind of thing, we actually have a stress response, which is natural. You know, humans are stressed by not knowing, but that's actually now it's seen as a good stress. And this is something that I didn't know. Most people don't know. And when you begin to think about it, you walk into a party and you're stressed by not knowing how the evening will go. But if you really begin to think about it, actually, your working memory is bolstered. Your attention is heightened at that point. Scientists call it curious eyes. And your brain becomes more receptive to new data. So it's sort of like being on. We're on. We're turned on by the unexpected. And that's a signal that there's something to be learned at that moment. It's not a signal it shouldn't be a chance to run, to hide, not deal with the uncertainty. What moves us forward is to actually contend with that and kind of dive in. It's a lot about being mindfully present, actually. And so CEOs who are ambivalent are actually more inventive in the middle of a crisis. Or I had this great nanny, actually, who became a scientist, and she was a very cool person who kind of helped me raise my kids. And I remember she called me up. She didn't really know that I was working on a book on uncertainty at that point. She called me up. Her, biotech company was going to go through a merger, and she was saying, "Oh, Maggie, oh no, it's uncertain, it's uncertain." And she was complaining and kvetching. But then in the same breath, she started saying, "Well, I'm dusting off my resume and I'm looking for internal jobs and something that's a little more aligned with what I want to do." And I was just sort of laughing / taking notes, because she was actually being provoked in a good way by the uncertainty. And that's what we can do with it.
Yeah. When I was reading about this, I kept thinking about two things. I mean, that so much of this is kind of a mental, frame shift of an expectation gap, maybe. I think about travel a lot. I was a travel editor for a very long time, and I've written about how traveling actually gets me out of my anxiety. I've traveled after each of my babies, and it's really shaken me out of my postpartum anxiety, despite the fact that travel is inherently uncertain. Like, we don't know what's going to happen next, but the expectation is that, oh, this is an adventure. This uncertainty is probably good for me. And this is going to be exciting. And yet, when we're faced with uncertainty in, say, the job market, of getting laid off and having to face those challenges, there's a negative bias before we even begin. So we don't see it as the same kind of adventure, despite the fact that it's the same uncertainty that's there. So it really is this mental shift that I think would do all of us so much good.
Yeah. And of course, life is not a picnic. And when you have a cancer diagnosis or you do lose your job, that in and of itself is not a good uncertainty. But at the same time, by pivoting, as you're saying, by kind of looking at the world with curiosity and wonder and not with that fear that cloaks everything we do, we can actually move forward. And when you're uncertain, when you're in that moment, scientists call it arousal. That's when you're really, as I'm saying, wakeful, when you're really on your toes. So if you walk into that Monday morning meeting, there are a couple of different ways you can kind of inhibit or refuse to pick up on the wisdom of uncertainty. You know, first of all, you can think, oh, life isn't going to change, and I hope it doesn't change, and I really want an easy day, and oh, this is just going to be the same old boring meeting. Well, studies show that, you know, scientifically, you're less likely to pick up on uncertainty in the room or the nuances, the change in the tone, et cetera. You've checked out. But at the same time, fear and anxiety, like, oh my gosh, I'm so upset about having a meeting with my boss that I'm not actually present in the room. I'm more thinking about how I might get fired or thinking how I might not get my bonus. So actually, uncertainty is not just a kind of wakefulness. I think of it as a kind of honesty because you're really right there. If you're uncertain, it's also a space of possibilities. So you're picking up on what might be, because that's what uncertainty is. It's not ignorance. It's not like, I don't know anything about particle physics or black holes. I'm ignorant. And if I'm uncertain, well, it might be this. It might be that, you know, the product might work, but I'm not sure. So you can see when I'm talking about it, there are possibilities there. And so it really is, I do open water four-season swimming. It happened when the pools closed during the pandemic. I kind of moved more, you know, to the ocean. I was in city ocean, but now I live mostly by the ocean because I started swimming and then I just kept going in the fall and the winter. And that is pure uncertainty. I mean, honestly, even 1 minute into your swim, you don't know what the waves or the, you know, currents or the, you know, wildlife around, you know, anything is going to do.
Yeah, you have no idea.
No, you really don't know because it's the ocean after all. It's out of your hand. And I can only kind of, you know, not get lost and that kind of thing. But what I realized, I kept thinking, why is this so good? Oh, yeah, it's exercise. Oh, it's great social hour, you know, during pandemic, which was golden. But I really finally, after a few years of doing this, realized that it's a daily dose of uncertainty. And so it's wonderful that it actually carries over into the rest of my day. You know, when things don't go as I planned, well, I'm kind of, you know, swimming in it in a more open-minded way, you know, curious way. And that's a really great place to be.
It is. It is. You know, I was very surprised. I had never done an open water swim before. I did a triathlon in Key West. And I was like, it'll be the same as the pool. It's fine. And I had a massive panic attack the first time that I got into that water. I mean, it's dark and it's murky and there's things that are touching you from below and you don't know what those things are. But I got through it. I pushed through it. I didn't grab the kayak. I went for it. And when I got out, I felt amazing.
Yeah. No, it's a real high. And I think what's really interesting is that no one's dropping me off in the middle of the ocean. I'm not, you know, completely over my head. I can swim. I know that beach, et cetera. But this is exactly where humans thrive, at the edge of the unknown. So uncertainty is actually opening up the space between question, can I do it? Can I get through this swim? And answer, oh, yes, I can. Or maybe I had to cut it short that day. So you're opening up the space between question and answer, but you're doing it in a way that you're, you know, at the edge of what you know, not, you're not sort of leaping into, you know, in over your head metaphorically and also physically. And that's where humans thrive. There's something called the zone of proximal development, which is often used for child development. It's kind of a euphemism for that scaffolding you can do. Your kid's doing a puzzle. They're a little stuck. It's a little old for them. You give them a little helping hand. You're helping them remain on the zone of proximal development. But that's basically how all humans thrive. We flourish. One scientist told me it's like the green buds on the tree. It's where we're kind of putting out shoots. And that's where uncertainty is like. If you are certain, your mind is closed, you know the way, or you think you do, and then you're going to be blindsided, or you are closing out that opportunity. I'm certain the party will be bad, so I'm not going to go, or that date won't work out. So I think it's easier to stay home and watch a movie. And that's really not picking up on the uncertainty and the opportunity that is uncertainty.
We are going to take a quick break here. Be right back.
This podcast is sponsored by Skylight Frame. Mother's Day is almost here. What are you getting her? Something that shows you care. Something that makes her feel loved. Something that won't stress you out. Something like the Skylight Frame. The Skylight Frame is the perfect gift. It's a touchscreen photo frame your whole family can upload photos to, from wherever they are in the world. It's a way to share with her all the moments that matter. It sets up in seconds. You can even make sure that it's already loaded with photos when your mom opens her Mother's Day gift. And her Skylight Frame can hold thousands of the treasured photos you share. It's an easy, heartfelt way for mom to stay connected with those who matter most. It really is the perfect gift. Now, as a special Mother's Day offer for our listeners, get 15% off your purchase of a Skylight Frame when you go to skylightframe.com/easy. That's SKYLIGHTFRAME.com/easy. Get 15% off your Mother's Day purchase now at skylightframe.com/easy.
Did researching and writing this book change how you view these things? And I don't want to be so glib as to say, did it change your life? But, you know, did it bring more curiosity to your days?
Absolutely. I was surprised. I was almost reluctant to write this book. I was writing a book about thinking in the digital age and what kinds of thinking we need. And the first chapter was about uncertainty. And then I discovered all this new research, which was fascinating. And then how wrong we are. And, well, you know, we thinking of uncertainty as weakness and inertia. So, you know, flat out, I just decided to write about the book. But time and time again, I mean, I wrote about creative daydreaming and the kind of productive uncertainty that the expert, like the surgeon, needs when they're in a crisis. And I wrote about the uncertainty that helps us get along with people whose politics we loathe. And I really found that, you know, first of all, it helped me see the world as inherently unpredictable because, you know, I often really did think, oh, my research or my writing should go more smoothly. And what's wrong with me that I'm frustrated and that I can't find the answer to this question when I'm, you know, doing my research? But I realized, and, you know, studies bear this out, that you know, research is frustrating and writing is frustrating. That's code word for your thinking. And so is uncertainty. And so that was the first peak. Also, just in little ways, you know, I realized that when a friend or one of my daughters was in crisis, I would, you know, be there for them. But very often, and I think other people are the same way, I would want to offer a solution and, you know, and kind of suggest this, you can do this, and this. And then I realized that actually I could be there with them, not in a passive way, but in a more kind of holding on to the space of uncertainty together in a way that enabled them to reflect on the possibilities rather than have me kind of nudge them like a shepherd dog down one path that I thought was the right path. And so, yeah, there's this sort of opening up with uncertainty. And, you know, it's never a picnic. Uncertainty is not where humans want to be. I think of often as the sort of the image of the rabbit in the field, you know, freezing. You know, it's kind of not where they want to be, but that's how we evolved to actually pick up information, that sort of freeze response that evolved into reflection and, you know, making use of uncertainty. And so I think but the difference between people who are anxious actually and fear the unknown and people who can be curious and wondering and et cetera, is that the first group, the fearful group, sees uncertainty as threatening. And the second group, who has more kind of mental well-being, it sees the uncertainty as a challenge. So threatening versus challenge, that's really important. And so we don't have to think this is easy street, and we don't have to think of this is a picnic or why am I not super comfortable with bungee jumping? Ooh. You know, I mean, we can be challenged by uncertainty and yet really thrive in it. And that was a really big, you know, that was the sort of a multi-year revelation to me.
You know, when I was reading the book, I also kept thinking about my own journey through motherhood, of becoming a mother. You know, 7 years ago, I had my first baby, and I remember nothing went as planned. The birth didn't go as planned. The babies do not go according to your plan. You have no idea what it is going to do next. And that uncertainty, like, really broke me the first time around. It did. It did. It turned me into an anxious mess. And when I had my second baby, and really when I had my third baby, the uncertainty, I allowed it to turn into what you call a certain curiosity. I was like, you can't approach it as if all of this is going to be bad or dangerous or terrible. You have to approach every part of this parenting journey with curiosity, or you're not going to get through it, girlfriend.
No, exactly. And I think it's really important to realize that there are really big, you know, natural cognitive reasons why we do want familiar, and we thrive, and we need familiar and routine and predictable, et cetera, because, you know, we learn from the past, and then we have expectations that something will be the same. Like, I wake up and know I can, you know, get, you know, go on the commute to work, and I'm not going to have to think too deeply about that. You know, life is a lot. Scientists call it predictive processing. So we have these mental models, and then doctor hears chest pains and then thinks heart attack. And that's all really good. That shows we've accrued life experience. And even when you're pregnant, you read about kids and you kind of learn. And then, you know, then comes along what the scientists call prediction error, you know, aka uncertainty, and your mental models are broken down. And yet that's the reality check that we need in order to update our understanding of the world. And we just can thrive in that. But it's not easy street. And so it's okay to kind of, you know that we will yearn from the familiar, but also know that we all, you know, I called it an epic chance when I first discovered all this about the, you know, pivot point certainties. And in draft of my one chapter, I called this an epic chance. You have an epic chance when you're uncertain to, you know, move forward and update your idea of the world. And then, you know, and my co-agent was looking and saying, epic, that's too strong. And I assert it's epic. This is epic. This is epic. And also I love
it. Does feel epic.
Yeah. And I love the idea that, you know, Annie Lamont wrote that book, Operating Instructions, as in there aren't any with parenting. It's really true. Mm-hmm. My little confession is that when my firstborn, you know, came along, okay, yes, I raised a baby for a few years. And then the second came along, and I kind of thought that she would be the same way. I thought if one spit up, the other one would spit up. If one, you know, napped at this time, the other one. And that was, now that I think back on it, I think, are you crazy? Do you really think two human beings be that much different, you know, that much the same? So anyhow, I was, you know, prediction error.
Shocking. I'm like, no, of course. I mean, if one slept through the night at 3 months, why did I think the other one was going to sleep through the night at 3 months? That is crazy.
Right.
That is crazy.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Well, you went to the subject of uncertainty from the subject of being distracted, which I also, you know, just blew my mind in, I'm going to say, an epic way. And I do not think that is too much. We talk so much on this podcast about how we are all so distracted and pulled in so many different directions at once. But, you know, I think I ended your book feeling hopeful that we're not going to a terrible place because of this distraction. How did you land on that?
How did I start to write that book, or how did I land ending?
more on the ending, because I think, you know, we do hear so much doom and gloom that we're so distracted, our attention is being pulled in so many different directions. This can only get worse,
right?
There's a different ending that we can imagine here.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, that's kind of what I feel about life, I suppose. I mean, partly I spent a long time as a foreign correspondent in different countries. So I was always looking around at our world as if I was some sort of Martian parachuting in, and that gave me a great perspective. And then secondly, I spent a long time writing about work-life balance, which is all about incremental change. So I'm a big believer in small steps actually mounting up to incredible change. And I think that's true of distraction. And one reason I'm heartened by the fact that, you know, although people are wedded to their phones for hours a day, and this really truly is a sobering issue, not just because we are, you know, kind of glommed onto a stream of what scientists call certainty-seeking devices, you know, neat pat answers that kind of push away the messy liminal and gray areas of life. Is, you know, the more time we spend online, the more time we sort of think that, you know, first of all, A, we know more than we do. We lose the limit, the recognition of the limits of what we know. That's really important for the learning we're talking about. And we're also, you know, become wedded to the fact that success means instant and push button, when all that we've been talking about is about slow victories and, you know, hunches or wrestling with something or picking up on a nuance or et cetera, journeys of the mind rather than click button, you know, experience. Mm-hmm. So I was hopeful in a sober way about our attention spans, because I feel as though, first of all, there's a lot of new fantastic science about what attention is. It wasn't more than about 20 years ago then it was thought to be this mysterious enigma that no one could study. And now they're beginning to crack the code. You know, just for instance, there are three types of attention. There's focus, which is like the flashlight of your mind. And that's what babies learn most, to orient to what's important. And then there's awareness, that's wakefulness. So I tell people in talks that you can be focusing on me, but be half asleep while I'm talking. And those are two different. And then finally, there's executive attention, kind of the symphony conductor of your mind, because what you attend to is what your life is. And I would say this is why I wanted to write about uncertainty, because so if you can have some skill in focusing, and now we're beginning to learn how, and putting down our devices is just one part of that. If you can have that, well, then, you know, how will you think, or what will you do with the thinking mind that you've enabled by being focused? And uncertainty is the unsung skill set there. So I'm just to briefly at one more point of hope is that, technology, the history of technology comes in stages. This occurred, I did a lot of study, the advent of the telephone or even the bicycle or the telegraph, et cetera. And what happens is the inventors dominate the conversation and try to tell the public what it's good for. And then people adopt these technologies, and then they're kind of, you know, not sure, but they are usually falling into, oh, this is all wonderful, or this is going to ruin our lives. So we have this binary, you know, kind of stage. And then there's a more nuanced, mature discussion. And that's where we're here at now. I think the backlash that we've seen, but then the, you know, the investigation of detoxes. And then, you know, just today in the New York Times, there's a big article about an Australian school where the kids go and don't have any technology for a year. Wow. Hey, it's happening. We're innovating. We're experimenting. And as long as we can keep hold of the idea that technology doesn't have all the answers for how we use technology, if you know what I mean, then we can retain our humanity and capture and be skillfully attentive.
Yeah, no. And I think that's what I found so hopeful. I mean, I love things that are these kinds of reminders of we can be skillfully attentive. We're in control here when we choose to be.
Exactly. Exactly. And the mantra that, oh, it's coming, or technology is with us, or that removes the agency, or whatever word you want to control, the power mm-hmm. of them to control every minute of your day, you're making minor or, you know, kind of the fabric of life is made up of tiny little decisions. Right now, I'm trying to persuade my husband not to use his cell phone in the bedroom because I know all the technology. And it's just there's no reason why he has to, you know, look at the surf report, which we do need for our swimming. But, you know, just before bed or the baseball scores, that's a kind of a great time for us to talk or, you know, just to have a human room left.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'll link this also to uncertainty, because one of the ways I try to investigate distraction by doing a kind of walkabout and thinking about it in all these different ways, everything from mobile living to the virtual spaces seemingly heaven-like. And I did the same thing with uncertainty. I'm trying to walk about it and see it in different modes. And I mentioned daydreaming, I mentioned deliberation, but there's also doing nothing. That's a kind of, you know, your grandmother or whoever says, sleep on the problem, honey, or, you know, take a moment. And the science behind that is overwhelmingly, you know, the jury is in. If you even rest for 5 minutes after learning, you know, just, I don't know, learning something on YouTube or being in a conference and hearing a great lecture or presentation, you take 5 minutes and do nothing. Now, I mean nothing. Don't think about what you just learned. Nothing. And certainly don't be on technology. That you'll not only boost your memory for that by 20-30%, which is pretty stunning, but you're also more likely to get the gist of it or can make connections. This is, you know, the kind of doing nothing that is really seen as unproductive, but it also is, you know, tremendously productive in a kind of stealth way. The studies are amazing. So it's really important to just allow the mind to catch up with experience. That's what I think of it as.
Oh, I love that. I really love that. I mean, the case for doing nothing is something I remind myself of every single day. And yet I need the reminder every single day, which, yeah, yeah. And I'm also on a mission to have my husband not use the phone in the bedroom. And, you know, let me know if you find that trick, that magic thing that keeps it out, because I haven't figured it out yet.
Yeah, I'm trying, you know, speaking of incremental, I'm trying to ask for, maybe this is too much, but I'll try it for a month, because I found that when it, you know, there was no phone in the bedroom for some accidental reason, even for a night, the whole tone changed and we were sort of more together and present. I don't think he completely saw that as much as I did, but I'm trying this sort of, let's try an experiment with this. And then hopefully the recognition will go. And then there's always just, oh, you know, kind of crying. I'm just joking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No. I'm not joking. The sighing side eye doesn't work for me. So I'm like, the experiment, he likes an experiment. He's a scientific mind. And so I think an experiment might work here.
Right. It just as maybe it can for all of us, you know, the incremental little ways are really important. You know, that's really, and the other thing that's really interesting, I think, about the whole idea of pausing, I call it fallow time. It's not just the 5 minutes, but it's also putting something aside. I'm now writing an article, and instead of just banging it out in a day or two, which would, you know, get it done faster, and I do have I'm allowed to spend a little bit more time. There's a flexible deadline, so that's lucky, but I'm just spending mornings on it. And then that allows me to come back to it. So that's the second part of uncertainty and action in fallow time. First of all, there's putting it aside and letting your mind percolate. But then secondly, you know, when you struggle to get back into something, you know, you're actually strengthening the, you know, sort of networks of the mind. The mind is your knowledge networks are kind of branching architecture, almost like a tree. So your cortex actually has connectivity between all the impressionist paintings that you know about. And even if you're forgotten something, as you do when you set something aside and you struggle to get back in, that's an actually like synaptic activation that helps you. So forgetting is a friend to learning. And that's absolutely beautiful. I talked to a potter, Chris Guston, really renowned international potter, who has to set things aside because that's the way his media works. You know, you have to let the pot dry before it can be fired. You have to, you know, do all sorts of things. And he's often on a particular artwork. And he almost talks about it as getting reacquainted with a friend. You know, where was he in the process of creating this artwork? Well, he has to, you know, reacquaint himself. And that's, he said, where he learns. And that's where the good work comes, in the not knowing.
I love that. Letting the pot dry before it gets fired.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
Let the pot dry. I'm going to end our interview on that. And will you tell everyone where they can find you on the highly distracting internets and the places?
Well, you can just Google Maggie Jackson and Uncertain or Distracted, my two most recent books, or go to my website, maggie-jackson.com. That's maggie-jackson.com. And you'll find lots of articles, resources, press interviews, all sorts of things. This has been such a pleasure.
This has been so fun. You've changed my whole outlook on my very uncertain weekend with three children in so many ways. And I'm going to do an open water swim at the lake up in the Catskills this weekend. I've got my wetsuit, and I haven't gone in a while, and I'm going to go.
I'm so happy. Well, it'll be uncertainty with a splash, right?
Uncertainty with a splash. I love it. And that is all we have for today. I loved that episode, and we did record this about a week ago. And since then, I did go jump in a freezing cold lake and take an open water swim, and I felt fucking amazing afterwards. And yeah, I think a little fish bit my toe, and I got touched by some weird things under the water, and that was nerve-wracking, and I felt that nervousness. But afterwards, I felt like I got my daily dose of uncertainty. I mean, not like I need more. I never know what's going to happen next. Do you know how uncertain I am about what is happening with this book this week? I'm so uncertain, and I'm so terrified. And I'm also like, God damn it, why is Amar Towles releasing a book on the same day as me? Oh, and Mary Kubica. Like all these big, amazing authors, same day. But you know what? I'm going to embrace it, and I'm just going to enjoy this book launch. Because you know what? The Sicilian Inheritance is the best book I've ever written. It is a fucking adventure, and I'm going to eat all of the cannoli and drink all of the Negroni and have a really great time. And a lot of that is thanks to Maggie Jackson, and thanks to this episode. And also thanks to all of you for being so awesome. I love you all. Go have a great day. Buy the Sicilian Inheritance. Seriously, I'm not even going to mince words at this point. Buy three of them. But then also go do something nice for yourself, because you know what? You deserve it.